Senate Labor, Commerce, and Tribal Affairs Committee is now in order. And I want to welcome all of the folks who have joined us. The work session agenda is fairly long, and we had a lot of interest in all aspects of retail theft that seems to be endemic right now. And we are going to go through all the different elements. And then we're going to have an update and overview on the adult entertainment industry. So those are the two topics we'll be dealing with in this work session. We'll be having another hearing in November during committee days, and members are welcome to suggest topics. We need to turn those topics in by Wednesday of this week. So with that, I would just like to introduce my interest in this first topic of retail theft. Goes back for a little more than a year. We had a big case in South King County of organized retail theft that involved a man in Auburn and Kent, a businessman, which is in my neck of the woods, who had been getting stolen goods in an organized theft ring and reselling them in many cases on Amazon, and over about 6 years had done something like $5 million in sales. He has been sentenced to prison now for his actions, but he is a tip of the iceberg, I'm afraid. So last year we had a bill 5533 that was relating to online marketplace retail theft and safety protections. It did not advance. So we're revisiting the entire issue today to see if we can't do a better job of getting new effective statutes in place next year in session. So with that, I would like to introduce our first presenter for this part of the agenda. We have Mike Webb, Chief of Staff at the Attorney General's Office, and Barbara. Is Barbara on board now?
I don't see her yet, Senator.
Okay, so we'll start with Mike Webb from the Attorney General's Office. Mike, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Kaiser and Senator King and honorable members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here. I'm sorry that you were stuck with me by myself, but I will do my best to present this information to you. We really appreciate the opportunity to talk about the task force that we formed earlier this summer and some of the goals, some of what we've accomplished thus far and what we hope to accomplish going forward. So we have a slide presentation for you. I will just say next slide, if that's okay, to staff, and then we will go. And I'm happy to take questions as we go or at the end of the presentation. Just some overview. Washington State is now the 10th state with a statewide organized retail crime task force. Nine of those are in the Attorney General's office. One of them is with the equivalent of the State Patrol, and that's in California. We have connected with most of those states either before or after launching the organized retail crime task force. I should give a credit to Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul, who was very instrumental in getting Attorney General Ferguson to take this step. He strongly encouraged us to exercise our convening authority to do this work. And so that's what got the ball. One of the things that got the ball rolling. The focus of our task force, the scope, if you will, we are focused on organized retail crime, not shoplifting, not economic crimes. So some of the indicia for organized crime would be multiple offenders working together, a sophisticated scheme, and certainly stealing for the purpose of reselling it for a profit, not for personal use. Any of those could indicate organized crime. And so that is what we're focused on with the task force. And next slide, please. Won't spend too long on this slide. This is just some examples of recent news items involving organized retail crime that we've seen in our state. The purpose of this slide is simply to highlight that this is a statewide problem that demands a statewide response. Next slide, please. The four goals that we have identified with the task force is, number one, increase coordination, communication, and collaboration across the state. And that is both between law enforcement agencies and what is multi-jurisdictional crime, but also law enforcement with impacted stakeholders, businesses, workers, et cetera. We want to center workers' voices in this effort. We want to research reforms and identify best practices to address the challenge. And we want to increase law enforcement resources to combat the problem. And I'll talk about each of these goals individually in the rest of this presentation. Next slide, please. So the first goal of increasing coordination, one of the task force, that is a central purpose of the task force. The first meeting was on Thursday, July 7th. It was attended by well over 100 individuals representing, we had representatives of state, federal, and local law enforcement agencies there from across the state, west side, east side. We had workers representatives, we had retailers, the retail community, we had small business representatives, and we had representatives from most of the online marketplaces, the online platforms. We have a second meeting scheduled on Wednesday, November 30th. And again, the primary purpose of these meetings is just to, for every one of those groups to identify both successes, but certainly challenges. Challenges that you're seeing, what are you struggling with? What do you want to see? What would help you address the problem as you see it? And then, you know, how can we all work together to accomplish those goals? Next slide. We're also, so it's not just the meetings, we're engaging in listening sessions. Right now, between meetings, we've met with dozens of retailers, large and small. Tomorrow, we meet with Amazon, and that will be the last of the major online marketplaces. We're trying to meet with each of them individually, and we're meeting with local law enforcement, the Fusion Center, and we're meeting with the other state task forces, as I mentioned. Next slide. I won't spend too much time on this, but I am pleased to see that we have, it seems like we have several essential workers here who are here to provide their perspective. We think that's very valuable in this debate. And I don't want to sort of minimize the impact to our economy or to our businesses and our small businesses, but I think it's obvious that organized retail crime impacts our business community. What is sometimes less obvious is the impact that it has on workers. And you know, essential workers in these stores are on the front lines of addressing the problem. It's a safety issue for them. It's also an employment issue. It is. It goes to worker morale, and they will. They'll tell their stories better than we can. But centering those voices has been a goal of ours. Another, obviously, protecting consumers is a major goal of the Attorney General's office. So I will highlight another, maybe unrecognized impact of organized retail crime, and that's on the impact on consumers. And I will just one example is even before the well-publicized shortage of baby formula that was big in the news this summer, baby formula has long been identified as one of the top items stolen in retail crime in our state and nationally. And you know, something that's not always recognized is if you're purchasing baby formula on the secondary market, you don't know whether it's been stolen. And if you purchase baby formula that is expired or it wasn't stored properly, it wasn't stored at the correct temperature, you know, there's a health and human health and safety impact that that we certainly want to avoid. So just one example of the impacts of organized retail crime on consumers. And next slide. Reforms and best practices. We're working on this in a number of ways. We're supporting the Washington Retail Association is coming up with a guidance for businesses what to do when you're impacted by organized retail crime. We're also partnering with the King County Prosecutor's Office and supporting their efforts to develop similar guidance, and it's and also guidance to local law enforcement agencies. For example, just an example of something that really helps businesses is if you are what's not always obvious is if you have video evidence of a crime, the prosecutor is going to want that is certainly going to want that eventually. And so one item that we're trying to get the word out is provide that right away. Don't wait for law enforcement to ask for it. If it actually gets deleted, if you thought that eventually they would ask for it, if they wanted it, they would have asked for it. So I've deleted it. Well, that would be a big mistake. That's a key piece of evidence. And if it's been deleted, that's going to really hurt any criminal prosecution. Same with any way to identify exactly what was stolen and how much, to do that right away and provide that evidence to law enforcement right away. It's different guidance depending on the size of the business and whether you have, you know, what level of sophistication you have, what resources you're able to put into fraud prevention efforts. But anyway, this, I think getting the word out is really important. The other thing that a long-term goal of ours, and we're not there yet, but we're really going to focus on trying to help prosecutors differentiate between shoplifting or economic crime and organized retail crime. You know, there's a appropriate criminal justice response for both. But, you know, if somebody is stealing because of a substance use disorder, that may well be an appropriate case for diversion. You certainly want to handle that case a lot differently than you handle a sophisticated retail crime theft ring, where you want to devote significant resources to that case because that's going to be a complex prosecution. And you're going to want to do what you can to try to get at all the actors that are benefiting from the crime. Next slide, please.
Madam Chair?
Go ahead.
I just wanted to let you know, it looks like Barbara is on now.
Oh, excellent. Well, Mike needs to know that too.
Yes.
And so Mike, I don't know if Barbara has a portion of this presentation or...
She does, and it's real time. This was one of her slides. So I'm proud to introduce Barbara Serrano, who's an assistant attorney general and a prosecutor in our office. And she's one of five individuals that the attorney general has designated to work on this issue on a part-time basis. We're not able to invest any full-time FTEs, but Barbara, we have two consumer protection assistant attorneys general, Ben Carr and Joe Canada. And we have two policy staff, our policy director, Sahar Fathi, and our policy analyst, Jamie Tugenberg. And so they're working very hard on this issue. And so I'm proud to be working with Barbara and introduce her. Barbara, if you want to take on this portion of the presentation.
Yes.
5 minutes left, Barbara.
Thank you, Mike. And I apologize, I was having trouble logging in. So we've been meeting with retailers, loss prevention folks, law enforcement, and prosecutors since the July 7th meeting. And one of our key goals is to encourage and improve cooperation between the online marketplaces with law enforcement and the retailers, getting everybody working together. And we're also trying to improve data collection, improving, you know, reporting of these incidents to police. Because one thing we've learned is that there are a lot of retailers who are not reporting these incidents, either because they don't think anything will happen, they don't think police will come. And the problem with that is that it doesn't allow us to get a really good picture of what is happening in the community. So we are meeting with everyone we can think of to encourage cooperation and share information. Next slide, please. So one of our goals is to provide a contact tip sheet and guidelines for law enforcement and prosecutors. So really sort of providing them guidance on how to put these cases together. These are really difficult cases. I mean, these cases require a lot of legwork, talking to witnesses. As Mike has talked about, you know, our goal has always been to move beyond the folks who are going into the stores and stealing the goods. We want to get to the folks who are fencing the goods online and the folks who are really profiting from these enterprises. Next slide. So as I mentioned, these crimes are very difficult. I mean, they can take months and even a year to put together because, again, you want to get beyond the shoplifting part of the crime. One of the things that we've learned that's a huge issue is, you know, police departments, as you all know, are suffering from loss of officers who are leaving their jobs, positions that aren't filled. And so there is difficulty in, you know, trying to make sure that these types of crimes receive priority, because of course, the fallback position for most police officers and even prosecutors, police departments and prosecuting office, prosecuting attorneys is to focus on violent crimes. But we know from the data that these types of crimes really have an impact. They have an impact on the retailers, the community at large, the safety of the employees and the safety of the public. One thing I want to mention is that King County in particular is handling many of these cases, and they have one deputy prosecutor who is assigned to retail crime. She has enough cases, you know, for three people. And one of the things that I've been talking to them about is, you know, the fact that they are having difficulty putting their cases together because, again, these cases need additional work. And they just don't have, they don't have investigators at the King County Prosecutor's Office to work up these cases. Next slide. I'm going to turn over to Mike.
And so this is the, what we want to close the presentation out with is to let you know that we have made a formal budget request to OFM to create a permanent statewide organized retail crime unit in our office with full-time FTEs. We're requesting funding for two full-time prosecutors, four investigators, and one data analyst. It's about $3 million biennial request, $1.5 million annually. And it is very similar to what Michigan just funded, adopted a retail crime task force in the AG's office at about $1.75 million a year. And Arizona legislature just did it at about $1.5 million a year. So similar to what other states are pursuing. We hope you'll review this and hope you can support it. We're happy to provide any information that we have. But we do believe that, you know, this funding won't obviously allow us to address all the problems in the state. It will allow us to coordinate multi-jurisdictional help investigations and stings. And the two prosecutors will allow us to take cases from across the state. We do think that there is a tremendous deterrent value if we can do a couple of high profile prosecutions of sophisticated retail crime, that it will really send the message that the state is taking this seriously and investing resources into combating the problem. Thank you for your time. Hopefully we didn't go over. We are happy to answer any questions that you have.
Great. Thank you very much. And I do see a question from Senator Schessler also Senator Conway. So let's start with Senator Schessler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mike, you talked about the two types of theft, the professionals and those that are maybe not professionals have other issues. If some department, I assume that theft of the first dollar is a crime, but how does the policy of not prosecuting under certain thresholds fit into fighting retail theft, organized retail theft?
Thank you for this question, Senator Schessler. And I'm sorry if I wasn't clear. What I'm trying, we're not setting prosecution thresholds. We're simply saying, hey, we're devoting resources to this issue, and this is how we're, where we think the resources in our office are best served. So certainly local law enforcement, local prosecutors, you know, there is an appropriate criminal justice response to all theft. But in terms of getting folks together to talk about the issue and to figure out best practices and reforms and how we can do this better, we think our resources are best served focusing on the organized aspect of the crime.
Well, I appreciate that, Mike, but since retail theft at $1 is against the law, if cities or counties don't prosecute under a threshold of, say, $1,000, does that not hinder your ability to get to the problem? They just let them walk if it's under $1,000?
Well, thanks for the question, Senator. I can't speak for local prosecutors and their decisions. I will say that I think you're going to hear from the other speakers. There is a brazenness as we hear reports from around the state from all stakeholders. You know, there is a brazenness to some of these crimes. It is alarming. You know, and so I think that's something that we need to wrestle with, and that the legislature and policymakers need to wrestle with, and we need to wrestle with. But I, in terms of like different prosecution decisions made in the 39 prosecuting attorneys' offices, I can't speak to that.
Let's move on, if we could, to Senator Conway, and quickly, because we're running a little tight now. You're still muted. You are muted.
I have a question, Mike, whether or not, I mean, it seems like in listening to one of the testimonies or one of the problems you pointed out, whether the problem lies on the state level or whether it lies on the local level and enforcement on the local level. It just seems to me that, from listening to that one case that Barbara spoke to, that we do not have the resources. I view it as we have a real crisis in our criminal justice system right now. And I'm just wondering whether we want to put dollars on the state level or whether we need to really direct them to the local level where the prosecutions are more important. Can you answer that question?
Sure, I can take a stab at it. Thank you for the question, Senator Conway. And ultimately, look, the resource challenges, and we might have breezed through that part of the presentation. The resource challenges at the local level are real and significant, and the 10 FTEs that we're requesting in our budget request, the two prosecutors, four investigators, a data analyst, and some support staff. I don't want to suggest that is going to allow us. I want to be clear. That's not even close to allowing us to sort of handle all the investigations and prosecutions in the state. Not even close. But, you know, there is an amplifier of having a centralized resource that can serve as a connector and a facilitator and a group that has expertise in this crime that is. You know, that is difficult to develop expertise at the local level. So we think that there's a real value to the approach that, again, other states are adopting as well. But, your question is a good one. Certainly, local governments need to be thinking about this challenge as well and what their resource decisions are.
Well, and one of the elements, this is not the Law and Justice Committee, you know, this is the Labor Commerce Committee. And one of the elements we're looking at here is the full gamut of this organizational crime and whether there should be a private right of action available for retailers to pursue recourse from online sales that are being transacted without any oversight. I would also mention, Mike, that you considered bringing in the Department of Financial Institutions. I see a lot of correlation between what's going on here and pawn shops. In the old days, when pawn shops were unregulated, a lot of product was moving through pawn shops and being resold. And this is an online pawn shop, in a way, of what's going on. And I wonder if Department of Financial Institutions might be an associated agency for regulation and oversight. They might bring them into the task force.
It's an excellent suggestion, Senator Conway. Thank you. Or Senator Kaiser, Chair Kaiser, thank you for that.
Thank you. Now we're going to move on to our next presenters, which includes fairly large retailers in our area. I would like to, the three presenters that will be on this section of the meeting is Terry Ryland with Walgreens, Ben Dugan, with the Director of Organized Retail Crime and Corporate Investigations of CVS, and Rory Stallard, the Senior Manager for the Home Depot, and he will be showing a video as well. So let's start with Terry. I see that you're up if you would like to present.
Absolutely. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on behalf of Walgreens to provide our perspective on organized retail crime. And hopefully I'll be able to paint the picture today of kind of what we are experiencing here at Walgreens with regard to organized retail crime and the impact that it has, not only on our team members, but also our patients and customers. So I've been with Walgreens for approximately 18 years and have investigated ORC and seen it transform from small-time thieves selling stolen goods at local shops and markets to your large-scale operations and organized thefts that have anonymity now by selling their stolen goods through online marketplaces. And to provide some context of what we see here in the state of Washington with regard to ORC at our 136 stores throughout the state, in the past 2 years, we've experienced a significant increase in the amount of product that our stores have lost compared to just two years ago and even to last year. And in conjunction with that, we are also seeing a significant increase in the amount of workplace violence incidents with our team members being threatened or even physically assaulted in our stores. And while we've implemented several mitigation strategies like guards, we have off-duty police officers in some of our stores. We've added additional high-risk product protection. We continue to see organized retail crime and even this violence being a large and growing concern in our stores. And when you shop at a Walgreens, the product mix that most of us come in for also happen to be some of those top items that we see stolen from an ORC perspective. So we're looking at your Advils, your Prevagen, Mucinex, Rogaine, Tides. We also sell beauty products that we also see in the online marketplaces that are significantly cheaper than what we sell in our stores. And even if you do a simple search of those online marketplaces, for example, like a Boots Number 7, which is a beauty line that we sell at Walgreens, you'll see multiple sellers that selling it for far cheaper than what you can purchase it for at one of our locations. And while the impact of ORC is significant at Walgreens, I would like to emphasize just one major concern that maybe other retailers don't experience, and that's really the safety and efficacy of the products that I mentioned above, and I think Mr. Webb mentioned as well, because as you buy those stolen products from online sellers, you don't necessarily know where that product has been. And a lot of that product ends up being stored in either trunks of a car or storage facilities where you don't necessarily know what type of temperature it's been, and it really degrades the efficacy of those products, leading to potential adverse reactions, you know, in our patients and our customers. And we also perform a large community service with folks that come in, get their immunizations, get their flu vaccine. Hopefully all of you have gotten your flu and COVID vaccines, maybe at a Walgreens. But there's often times where there's concerns with violence in those stores, and it keeps our patients away. And so really there is an impact to our patients and customers who would like to shop those stores as well. So with that, I thank you and welcome any questions that you might have, and I will turn it over to the next speaker.
Thank you, Terry. Let's move on right now to Ben Dugan with CBS.
Yes, good afternoon, Madam Chairwoman and members of the committee. I greatly appreciate the opportunity to speak to everyone today. I'm Ben Dugan. I'm the Director of Organized Retail Crime and Corporate Investigations for CVS Health. I'm also the president of the National Coalition of Law Enforcement and Retail. This is an organization with 3,000 members from both law enforcement and retail, investigators that are dedicated to combating organized retail crime. What I'd like to do, I'll be brief, Madam Chairwoman. I know we're on a tight schedule. So I really want to quickly provide maybe a national perspective and where Washington State plays in organized retail crime nationally. You might have seen, I am familiar with the case the senator mentioned earlier in Washington State, but you may have seen the large case we closed with our partners at Walgreens most recently in Chicago. It's one of the largest ORC cases on record, approximately $40 million in losses. And a lot of time, what didn't say was those networks of the thieves themselves, the online sellers, the fencing operations, it spanned way beyond Chicago into 14 other states, including Washington State. As a matter of fact, some of the stolen products we recovered in Chicago are directly linked to violent retail thefts here in Washington State. And Washington State has always been, a part of the landscape of organized retail crime nationally. As a matter of fact, to put it in perspective for the committee, out of the top 50 sellers of the products that CVS has identified as high-risk products, the top 50 sellers, 25 of them are located in Washington State. Half of the most illicit sellers in the country are located in Washington State. So we are super excited about what the Attorney General is doing. We certainly support his efforts to form that task force. I will say, Madam Chairman, I've been fortunate enough to be involved in a lot of those task forces across the country. And the leaders of those task forces, these great leaders from the Attorney General's offices, always say the same thing, right? Besides the task force, for it to be effective, we need transparency from the online marketplaces. So we fully support the Attorney General and his efforts. We greatly support the Informed Consumers Act, which hopefully will be reconsidered in Washington. We think that they are the most meaningful steps to curtailing retail theft, stopping the violence, and fighting crime. So I'll end it right there, Madam Chairwoman, and I pause for any questions.
Thank you, Ben. Let's move on to the next presenter, Rory Stallard.
Rory. Yes, Madam Chairwoman, thank you. Yep, yeah, you've got the pronunciation right. Thank you very much for your time. I definitely want to just kind of echo some of the thoughts of my industry peers. I don't know that you hear a whole lot different in terms of some of where our focuses are from a Home Depot perspective. I do have a couple of visual things that I want to be able to share. So I'll just ask for the next slide, and hopefully this video will play and you'll be able to see what I'm talking about. So we talked a lot about how these incidents and the ORC epidemic can impact from a lot of different perspectives, including, you know, our associates. And as I'm talking, there's a kind of a montage of videos that's going to play here where you can see the brazenness that was discussed earlier in some of the incidents of theft. Even though we may put merchandise devices to protect it, you may have someone steal a whole end cap. You may have someone walking out brandishing a pistol to our store associates. These are not asset protection individuals. These are regular store associates that are just trying to do their job, that are just trying to give some guest service, that are being assaulted, that are being knocked down, that weapons are being flashed. You just recently also saw some form of pepper spray being used. Even when our trained asset protection individuals are trying to make some of these apprehensions, they are being assaulted as well, even though they know that from an asset protection standpoint, they may have to come into contact with someone. They didn't necessarily sign up to be assaulted. We've got these organized activities that are happening in our stores and the threat of violence, as well as the actual violence that's involved, including this last one that you see that's queued up, which is pretty severe, which involves him actually being pistol whipped as he was exiting the store. And these are kind of scattered from all over the country. Next slide, please. So from a Home Depot perspective, our investigations, we talk about the complexity that separates it from the shoplifting. The investigations that we're involved with, when those thefts are happening in our stores, and it's usually multiple people, multiple events. I know I heard a lot of discussion about, you know, local jurisdictions, and of course, we're finding that our offenders are going from store to store to store, so not always in the same jurisdiction. That's why it's critical to have state involvement, that we don't have to parse out the cases in different local jurisdictions. And I know there's a lot of talk about product going into the online platforms, and I'm going to speak about that in a second as well. But these groups, while they are sophisticated, it calls for sophisticated means for our teams to investigate. We have a large presence, probably one of the largest presence from an industry standard, who are out there doing surveillance, who are working with law enforcement, using technology, using techniques, because these groups are sophisticated, and it's not just simply making an apprehension on someone in a store. And while that product can go a lot of different ways, what used to be typical brick and mortar fencing locations, over 90% of what we're seeing is involving some type of online fence now, even if it's connected to a brick and mortar location. And we're finding more and more that these violent offenders are involved in human trafficking, they're involved in narcotics, they're involved in weapons. Next slide, please. And the traditional fencing of where we used to have a pawn shop, or we would have some type of flea market or even a bodega, while that still does happen, what we're finding more and more is that pawn shop, that bodega, or that flea market, while it is truly still a brick and mortar location, they're running an online store out of the back room or from their home as well. And so most of our cases, like I said, around 90% are involving that online presence. So definitely the case that was mentioned earlier, we were impacted heavily by that case as well from a couple of online platforms. And our Pacific Northwest market is one of our more substantial shrink-focused markets. We're seeing some losses up there that are unparalleled to what we've had in the past. It's enough that we do have a dedicated team in that market that just works the ORC component. So we definitely appreciate the partnership from the prosecutors, from the Attorney General's office, and then, you know, from all the industry peers that are on this call, and also from this committee to help us put whatever resources we need to continue to fight this, because it is an ongoing battle in our stores, as you could see from the video.
Thank you, Rory. I noticed the video. I'm just going to ask, do you on a routine basis provide those videos to our local police agencies so that they can identify who's taking these goods?
Absolutely, absolutely. Most of those incidents are not a one-time incident. Mm-hmm. It's usually connected to some other case that is more organized and more substantial. So of course it rolls into the case. But anytime our associates are going to be assaulted, anytime there's that incident of violence, there's a reporting mechanism through Home Depot, and that information and intelligence would be shared with law enforcement to take care of that incident and also help us prosecute and build on the much larger investigation as well.
Thank you very much. Would anybody like to hazard a guess why Washington State is rated so high in this business of organized retail theft? Well, maybe Senator King would. He's got his hand up. You're still muted.
Sorry about that. Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, you know, when you defund police and you make it so difficult for them to work in the profession that they've chosen, and they're leaving or moving out of state, I mean, that's why. I mean, let's be honest. It's exactly why, because we don't have enough police and we've made it hard for them to operate. And I could go into a variety of things, but this is part of the problem.
Okay, Senator King, I appreciate your opinion. I don't agree with it, but I appreciate it. Barbara Serrano, did you have a question or a comment?
A comment. One thing that we've heard from law enforcement and from the retailers, one of the reasons that Washington has been a target of these crimes is because of the highway corridors. I know this is an odd thing, but because we have shopping centers and major retailers located along the freeway, for example, even the 405, Bellevue is a hot spot for these types of crimes, because you have all of those, you know, you have the mall right there and all of these big box stores. So, I mean, that's just a fact, right? So the I-5 corridor is popular. And I do want to mention these crimes do cross jurisdictions. And I think that's one of the reasons there's been local support for our role as an agency, is that, you know, you don't have to go to one particular county. You can have the AG take the case and handle it, you know, from several different jurisdictions.
Even in my local case, it was three different jurisdictions. So, and it was multi-million dollar goods. It wasn't shoplifting. It was definitely organized crime. So anyway, let's move on now to the next group of people who are going to testify about online theft, or not online theft, but retail theft and the workforce. And we have members of the United Food and Commercial Workers here to testify and present. We'll start with, I believe, Anna McAllister. Is Anna here? Anna McAllister?
She's on there. Oh, she's coming up, Senator.
Okay.
Hi, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Am I coming through?
I can hear you fine. Is your video available?
I don't think so. It usually comes up automatic, but it didn't. I'm sorry.
That's fine. Go ahead. Tell us about where you work.
Okay, now I'm there. Yes. Good afternoon. I appreciate this chance to talk to you. My name is Anna McAllister, obviously. I've been a member of UFCW and worked in the grocery industry for over 30 years, first at Top Foods for 21 and then Safeway in Kent for almost 10 now. When I first started with Top Foods, theft was just a poster board in our break room with Polaroid pictures of shoplifters we detained. But now it's an everyday occurrence with multiple incidents, and we aren't allowed to do anything about it, anything to deter it. When I first started working for Safeway, we had an assistant store manager who tried to stop a known shoplifter by yanking the bag that he was carrying out of his hand, and he was then fired for that. Just last year, we had a PIC who tried to stop a shoplifter and was fired for it. And then at a daily huddle that our store director held, she told us another PIC shortly after that was being disciplined for standing in front of the cart full of things that a customer had tried to walk towards the door without paying for. Our daily loss is listed by the time clock in our stores. It once began as hundreds of dollars, and the number's gone up into the thousands daily. As a seafood manager, I was told that I should keep a record of the theft from my department that I know of, because I'm held accountable if my gross profit falls short. It doesn't seem fair to me that the theft that the stores, the companies do nothing to deter, affects my department numbers, and then I'm held partially responsible. At my Safeway, we're told that we have to have our counters full and set for customers every day by a set time, but that's hard to do when you have customers that come in. Well, they're not customers, but they come in and fill up their shopping cart full of meat or multiple bags of shrimp, and then they just walk out without paying for it. It's really frustrating to deal with the theft, but our stores need to have effective deterrence, because employees like me are ending up, you know, being held accountable for the theft that they do nothing to deter. Thank you for listening to my story.
Thank you for presenting. Are you at the Kent store down on Washington?
Correct.
Good to see you. And you. Susie, go ahead. Susie Geffrey. No, you are still on
there. There you go. Okay. Hi, I'm Suzanne Geffrey, or Susie, and I appreciate the opportunity to share my story today, because I think it is does a good job of explaining what is wrong in the industry right now. I worked at Fred Meyer Richland, Washington for 2 years until earlier this year, when I was terminated for violating company policy related to intervening during a case of retail theft. I was working self-checkout on May 20th of this year when I got a call from our loss prevention manager. He asked if I happened to see the woman in the black hoodie in self-checkout. I said yes. He instructed me to intervene with the woman and then immediately hung up the phone. Sorry, I lost my place. There we go. We had always been instructed not to intervene in these kinds of situations, so I was a little unsure of what to do, but I went up to her in line to try and take her bag with what I assumed to be stolen merchandise. I did not know it at the time, but I later found out she was part of an organized ring of people in our area who were purchasing prepaid Visa gift cards with stolen credit cards. I later learned that on that particular day, this same woman purchased 9 $500 Visas with stolen credit cards. I was not given any kind of training on what the manager wanted me to do to intervene here, but I felt as though I needed to follow his instruction or I would lose my job. In fact, in this case, following his instructions got me fired, because when I did intervene here, I lost my job for violating company policy. Instead of being required to take preventative measures to deter this kind of theft, Fred Meyer punished me for doing what should be their job. Why are we as workers told to intervene in these situations, and when we do, we get fired for it? Why are workers in the industry allowed to be disciplined for following the instructions of management when we are not given any kind of training to intervene in these situations? I love this work, and I'm still working with my union to get my job back here. But the legislators need to step in so workers in these situations are not left holding the bag. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Susie, for sharing your story. I appreciate that very much.
Thank
we
you.
Have Sam Dancy. There you are.
Yes. I want to thank you, Senator, and all for being present today and allowing us the opportunity to elaborate on the situation. I'm not going to be redundant about some of the things that have already been stated, because that's been stated and it's on record. Anyway, my name is Sandra Dancy, and I currently work at the Westwood Village QFC, which is on the borderline of King County Incorporated in Seattle. I've currently been there for 31 years. My position is an FES, which is synonymous for front-end supervisor. And I'm also an executive board member for UFC 3000. Just so you know, PIC means person in charge. Each different grocery store has their own label. And first of all, on 12/91, even a sous chef position, I held for 15 years. I took the job because at that time, the grocery industry was considered a good union job with great benefits, pay, and pension. At that time, when I started, QFC respected us, they protected us, and they paid us, okay? And 30 years later, the national pandemic has changed the narrative. Gone is the respect, protect, and pay. For the first time in 31 years, I asked myself, how much longer can I maintain my sanity with all the retail theft that has changed the narrative? Customers and employees don't feel safe anymore, especially the workers, because there are no consistent understanding when it comes to retail theft. Approximately 2 years ago, I had a medical issue that had me out for about 4 weeks. 1 week after that incident, I came back to work with a PICC line in my right arm. I was conducting my job. I was conditioning the beer aisle, and a drunk customer decided that they wanted to grab quantities of beer. If it was not for a customer that's a friend of mine that had video and sound going on, I could have possibly had lost my job for 30 years, and I wasn't doing anything but just doing my job. Other people in this retail industry have not been able to experience the same thing. I find it interesting how it's always been called retail industry. Well, now there's a middle name put into that retail, and it's called retail theft. And I think for some reason, it has changed things within the industry. Okay, the associates and I and all the customers, we have discussed this, and we just ask that some type of measures be put in place to not only protect us, but also protect the customers. And we want to make sure that this doesn't happen before somebody either gets severely hurt or loses their job. And I want to thank Terry, Ben, and I believe it was Roy, who also know a lot about this retail theft industry, that elaborated on some of these issues so that you know currently what's before you. Thank you very much, all of you senators, for taking the time to listen to mine and all the other associates' situations when it comes to this measure.
Thank you, Sam. I appreciate your testimony as well. Now we have Dustin Lambro.
Thank you so much, Senator Kaiser, and appreciate you holding this hearing today. I am Dustin Lambro. I'm a political and legislative director at UFCW 3000. I'm here today on behalf of Faye Gunther, our president, who's unable to join after all. We represent 50,000 members with the largest private sector union in Washington State, with more than 27,000 members who work at grocery stores like Safeway, Fred Meyer, QFC, as you heard from our members there, and many smaller stores like PCC, Town and Country. We also represent more than 4,500 members who work in retail stores like Macy's, Bartels, and also in the cannabis industry. We've done a pretty exhaustive job this year of conducting surveys with our members, having engagements, work site conversations on this topic in work sites all throughout the state. And we've found that pretty much every member sees this occurring every single day. And that the problem has only gotten worse, as you heard from Sam, who started in the industry in 1991. And resoundingly, our members are frustrated that their employers are not doing enough to deter these kinds of crimes that are happening on an organized basis. So we've got example after example of members like Suzanne who have been unfairly disciplined or fired for even talking to a customer who's trying to steal in an organized way. In Suzanne's case, she was simply following the instructions of the loss prevention manager. And in Anna's case, she has the added stress of being held accountable for theft from her seafood counter, just entirely outside of her department's control. Appreciate hearing from Mike and Barbara because Faye Gunther is also on the retail theft task force, and they are excited about working throughout the rest of the year to put together some proposals. I do want to be clear, and you heard this from Mike, that we're not interested in further criminalizing poverty or making communities who've been disproportionately impacted by policing to make them feel unsafe for just trying to go to the store to feed their families. But no one should be losing their job or being held accountable as a worker in retail store for these kinds of losses. So we very much look forward to continuing to work in the rest of the interim with you all on coming up with some solutions and appreciate you all being thoughtful as we worked together to figure out the balance of the needs of our members to have a safe workplace and customers a safe place to shop with the need to make sure that we're not further criminalizing poverty. But very much appreciate your time today, and I know we're happy to take any questions.
I don't see any questions, Dustin, but thank you for presenting. Wait, Senator Conway has his hand up.
Dustin, thank you for your presentation and thank you members for your participation in this. I guess I understand through in your last contract negotiations, you set up a committee to look at this issue of violence in our grocery industry. And I'm curious, do you have any updates on that dialogue with your employers? Because that is an ability through collective bargaining to try and find solutions to what we hear these members saying. You know, they're being held accountable for something they're told that they shouldn't take action on. That doesn't sound right to me. And so I guess what I'm wondering is whether we're making any progress there.
I think that work is ongoing, and I don't know that we've put forward any proposals yet, Senator Conway, and but we're happy to continue to update you all as we move through that process. But yeah, we agree with you that people should not be disciplined, particularly if they're being asked to do something and then get fired for it. So appreciate the question.
And we saw from the earlier video from Home Depot that there are actual physical assaults on employees. And I don't know if there's a policy in the industry on dealing with the result of those injuries or not, but we should ask those questions as well and make sure that anybody injured on the job in a retail theft event has good coverage and job protections, I would suspect. Both of those things are in need of attention as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you all. I appreciate the testimony. And now we're going to hear from the Northwest Grocery Association. And then after that, the independent groceries and convenience stores. Ryan Clevenger and Maria McGinnis. I know Maria is here because we had trouble getting her on before. And Holly Chisa is available for questions, I believe, right? Is that correct? Okay, let's go ahead then with Ryan.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Appreciate the time and I guess this topic here is a difficult one to discuss, because I think at the end of the day, all of the individuals that are testifying before you all have the same common goal in focusing on safety of our customers and our employees. And I represent the Safeway Asset Protection team, having done this for the past 23 years. And I echo that of our peers, and that the violence and the level of theft that we are seeing today in 2022 is like nothing we've ever seen before in the state of Washington. And whether you're a member of UFCW 3000 or you are a big box retailer like my peers, we're all experiencing the same level of violence. The information that is out there, unfortunately, with law enforcement, oftentimes doesn't tell the complete story as to what's occurring in our retail environments, whether it be grocery or big box, day in and day out, simply because the ability for us to report and do so uniformly varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. And so many retailers, such as Safeway and ourselves, have had to track our own crime statistics and really work on some of that, so that we can, when we meet with Mike and with the AG's office, present the true stories to what's going on. And just a quick snapshot, I won't bore everybody with the details on the specific numbers, but a three-year stack on violence that we are seeing in our retail environments is up triple digits year in and year out, starting with 2019. It was up almost 200% into 2020, up 300% into 2021. And that is not just, you know, our friends at Home Depot did a great job demonstrating the physical assaults and whatnot, but getting into weapons and talking about, you know, the categories that we're tracking with the different types of weapons. Our Safeway Asset Protection data analyst has actually had to create a whole new tracking mechanism to keep track of all the different kinds of weapons used against customers and employees. So I echo that of our big box peers, as well as the our bargaining teams out there as well. We all have the common vested interest in trying to reduce this. And we keep talking about what can we do to mitigate or reduce this. And I'll be very clear from our perspective, the only way to address this is head on and full stop. We need to address organized retail theft from the top down. We've talked about prosecuting small levels of crime, your individuals that are trying to feed themselves, and crystal clear from the retailer perspective, that is not our target. Our focus is that of those highly organized and highly violent individuals, and that cascades down to impacting our customers, our pricing, our employee safety. It's all together. So I will. I'm not going to repeat what our friends on the big box said, but I will say from the AG's perspective, we've done a great job in painting that picture with the AG's office, and I'm very excited to hear the steps that our friends at the AG's office are attempting to take in getting funding. You know, we talked about the efforts at a local level versus a state level. And wholeheartedly support their commentary that it needs to be at the state level, because these highly organized individuals travel up and down the I-5 corridor, the 405 corridor, and they can target anywhere from 15 to 20 retail establishments across 50 to 100 miles in one day and get tens of thousands of dollars worth of merchandise in no time flat. So local importance and local data filing is critical, but state aggregation and state uniformity in how we address this and prosecute is absolutely critical. So I would be more than happy to take any questions when it comes to the specifics with the violence and the crime stats that we've had to track. But I'm looking forward to the committee's response and the AG's office efforts as this comes to a head.
Just a clarification, Ryan, you said a 300% increase in, did you say violent incidents?
Correct, violent incidents. And we actually even track going into weapons related incidents. For example, in 2021, we had a 235% increase in the usage of knives, guns, pepper spray, tasers. The number of increases in gun activity was up 228% just in a 1 year stack in our retail environments. And this isn't like a five or six incidents to get those large numbers. We're talking a 75 jumping to 139 gun-related incidents in a one-year stack. So this is not just one or two incidents. This is a very wide-scale issue, whether it be Spokane, Washington, or Tacoma, Washington. It is across the board with all of our retail environments.
Wow, that's really stunning information. Could you, if you have that in writing in any form, could you provide that?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Maria, go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to also bring up our concerns. So just like everyone else who spoke before me, we have the same issues. I am the investigator for Fred Meyer, and I've been with the company for almost 27 years. And in all my years, I have never seen crime, assaults, in the level of, or see crimes, the thefts that are just enormous. And they continue to happen day in and day out. But in all my years, this is the worst. And I personally believe that there are certain things that are driving these people. Besides the drug addiction, fentanyl, you also have e-commerce, which is the easiest way for people. Everyone has access. I shouldn't say everyone. A lot of these people have access to the internet, a phone. All you need is an OfferUp account, a Facebook marketplace. And they, if you notice, you'll go to any of our parking lots, you'll see they're all lingering because it's so easy to take a picture, post it, sell that item, and never take it down. And just continue to come in and get more, just a supply demand. So we are those people's warehouse. The assaults, I highly encourage, and I will tell, if anyone here feels safe having their family members, their daughters, their grandkids, anyone come into a store in the evening, just walking through a parking lot these days, it's a pretty scary situation. And we need help because none of us are in a bubble. We can invest in our company has invested millions in protecting our employees, our customers. And we are part of a community. So we're not in a bubble. Everything that is happening around us, it's all coming all together to a place where they don't want to leave. I think our laws, when it comes to prosecuting, the threshold is too high for ORC is 5,000. Hopefully we haven't changed it recently, anything higher, but it is 5,000. And repeat offenders, they know. The one thing about drug users, and I'll make this quick, that when you see them on TikTok videos, fentanyl, they're all sleeping upside down or, you know, taking a nap. But when they wake up, they're violent. And the only thing they can think about is coming to get that next fix. And they're not going to an ATM machine. They're coming to our stores and they're selling the merchandise to restaurants, bars, e-fencing. I said e-fencing needs regulations. But our number one concern will continue to be our employees and our customers. And thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Maria. And are you the person in charge of all of the Fred Meyer stores in Washington State? Is that?
Oh, no. No. I oversee investigator for Washington, Alaska, and Idaho.
Three states. Oh, my gosh.
I just came back from Alaska, and I felt like I traveled back in time. The stores were, there was nothing that is happening here. It's not happening in Alaska. The shelves were full. Wow. It was just a whole different, and another world.
Okay.
So, thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. It's good to have different perspectives. Now, Holly is available for questions, and I don't see any hands up for Holly, but I'm going to ask you, Holly, a question, which is, if all this product is being stolen and fenced to online buyers and so forth, what impact is that having on prices that people have to pay? I mean, In the retail world, you always had a little shrinkage, but from what the numbers are, it seems like we're looking at actual impact on the price of goods now.
Yeah, and Senator Kaiser, I appreciate the question. And for the record, I'm Holly Chiesa here on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association. And it does impact prices when you steal a particular product. It also impacts the availability of those items for consumers. And for example, the baby formula situation, when we had the shortage, we were locking up baby formula in certain stores. And it wasn't to prevent families from being able to access it. It was actually to prevent it from being stolen off the shelves to make sure we had enough for consumers to be able to purchase or use their benefits to be able to have access to those products. It is not a victimless crime. Organized retail theft affects our supply chains. It affects consumers who need certain items like formula. And clearly it affects our employees and our customers. And so we can't solve this problem by trying to mitigate it. We have to come headlong at it to prevent organized retail theft as a whole. And we are actually coordinating with Oregon. As a trade association, we do cover multiple states, and among our retail partners, trying to cover it in multiple states, trying to get at that I-5 corridor.
Senator Conway. You are muted, Senator Conway.
I was muted. I'm sorry. I was curious about whether there are some practices in other states to address the fencing of goods, and whether or not we need to do something more about the. It seems like the fencing is encouraging this kind of interstate theft, and I'm just curious whether there is something we can do in terms of the e-commerce to address this issue. I mean, it's seems like they do it because they can make money. That's why they do it. Okay.
Yeah, there are a number of different strategies, and Ryan, I know, has a couple of examples that he has experienced in other states. I know that we are looking at models out of California. We are, as I said, trying to coordinate our effort with the Attorney General's office in Oregon as well. I will say that the felony threshold in the state is $750, and it's a lot of merchandise to walk out of a grocery store at $750 just to hit a felony threshold. And again, we are not targeting individuals who are financially struggling. We are going after those organized rings and trying to look at solutions like how to better coordinate crimes across county lines, how to organize crime against state line. And I actually would like to hand over to Ryan if you've got any additional points that you'd like to raise in your experience in multiple states.
Sure. Thank you, Holly. So, Senator Conway, I would say that, honestly, a lot of the mitigation and strategies to address organized retail theft, we've heard most of them today. And I think the initial steps being taken by the Attorney General's office are absolutely the steps that we need to take to achieve the head-on impact towards organized retail crime. If you look at cities or states like Illinois, New Mexico, Utah, those three are the absolute champions in setting best in class for organized retail crime impact through the AG's office, coordinating the efforts across the state. And I would say, the old cutting the head off the snake, that's where you start. You have to start with the fencing operations. You start at the top. And the trickle-down effect is impactful to the levels of violence in the individuals that are creating that the opportunity that we've talked about today with our employees and customers being assaulted. So a lot of the strategies that that Mike and Barbara outlined from the AG's office, those are the infancy and the baby steps that we're taking to get there. But if we follow in the footsteps of Illinois, Utah, New Mexico, I see a tremendous impact. And honestly, the funding of dedicated prosecutorial and investigative resources at the state level is absolutely what is required to make this an effective impact and drive this activity out of the state of Washington.
Thank you, Ryan. I think that something like 12, maybe 13 other states have now taken action requiring online marketplaces to verify the products as not stolen goods and to ensure that their marketplaces, whether they are the big ones or the smaller ones, are not being used as fencing operations, which appears to be what they are being used for now. So if we can also make sure that we, as you said, cut the head off the snake, if that's the right term, but that seems to be where the resale value is for these organized crime rings in the retail world right now. I don't see any other hands up. So for this segment, we're going to be moving now into the independent grocers and convenience store world with Brody Kessler-Mouse and Tammy Hetrick available for questions. Brody, go ahead.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Brody Kessler-Mock. I'm a regional manager of Jackson's Food Stores and a member of the Washington Food Industry Association. Jackson's Food Stores operates 47 convenience stores in Washington, and we employ over 400 people. Each day, our goal is to provide our customers with the best-in-class products and services, in a way that's fast, simple, and friendly. And I'm here today to speak about our experiences with retail theft and the impact the crime is having on our stores, our customers, and our employees. It's become a daily challenge to keep both our customers and our employees safe. I'd like to just share a few of the issues that we've dealt with. Most recently, one of our managers was assaulted by an individual while he asked him to leave the parking lot. This individual is a repeat offender of shoplifting, but he was out harassing customers outside the store. So trying to keep the customers safe, in return, our manager was assaulted by this gentleman. We had a group of teenagers come into one of our locations in the Tacoma area after school and engaged in an altercation with another customer in the store. Another customer that was in there along with our employees tried intervening in this, and in return, they were one of our employees and one of the customers was assaulted as well. This continued outside the store for over 30 minutes before we got any response from law enforcement. And we did finally get response because there was a parent of one of the teens that was trying to defend their child, shot a gun in the air. But that's what it took to get response on this particular one. In addition to our convenience store operations, we also have fuel operations. And we had a fuel driver at one of our Puget Sound area locations. He had an individual approach him asking him for money. When he let him know that he did not pack any cash, this individual threatened to take a lighter out and ignite the fuel that was being distributed at the store in a late evening. So we had 20,000 gallons of fuel being dropped into in-ground tanks. This driver, who's been with us for a long period of time, just flat out said he would not go back into this location late at night. So we now since have started bringing in our tankers into the middle of downtown no later than 6 o'clock in the evening, which puts our drivers, you know, right at peak times coming in, delivering fuel. At another store, an individual was walking around the parking lot with the fuel islands and was swinging a hatchet at customers. And regrettably, it took 20 minutes to get any response on this instance as well. This gentleman, again, is a repeat offender in our stores. We instruct the employees there that whatever he takes, let him go, because we will not put our people, you know, at risk. These are just a handful of incidents that our employees and customers have faced. Seemingly every day our employees experience occurrences of shoplifting. If confronted, our employees routinely face threats from the shoplifters. As a manager, I often hear it is important for employers, especially retail employers, to continue to file the appropriate reports, and I appreciate the challenges faced by local law enforcement who are shorthanded and unable to respond to service calls. This is frustrating because it leaves our store employees feeling vulnerable to continued criminal acts, sometimes by repeat offenders. It also creates unsafe situations for our customers who may be visiting our stores. With that said, we continue to do everything we can to provide a safe environment for our employees and our customers. Here are just a few of the tactics that we're using to combat retail theft and crime in our stores. We have hired on-site security that we put in a few locations for several months at the cost of $65 an hour. This did not result in improvement or deter theft on the criminal activity on our properties. In March of this year, we started closing select sites at midnight, but we continue to staff one employee locked inside the store to try and avoid the vandalism that has occurred when we've shut these down. We have a minimum of two employees working on all shifts and have recently added one additional person just to monitor activity inside and out during business hours. We continue to call the police, but do not get any kind of response unless there is a major threat. Recently, we had a gentleman outside the store who refused to leave. Our employee called the police on day one, but this happened with no response. The man remained at the store for a second consecutive day, still no response. And this gentleman had multiple knives that we could see sticking out of his backpack. So again, you know, the store manager was instructed, please do not approach him. One of our managers who has been at the same location for more than 20 years with us has taken a 2-month leave of absence to decide if he wants to do this anymore. He has recently been threatened by an intoxicated individual because he refused to sell alcohol. The same individual saw him at our manager at the bus stop the next day and began harassing him as he was waiting for the bus. We are in the process right now of adding some pass-through security drawers at these locations that we've shut down at night, so we can at least do some kind of sales during the night hours that we are currently locked down.
Thank you, Brody. I'm gonna have to ask you to wrap up and—
Sure.
Go ahead.
You know, the last thing any business wants to do is suggest that their store is unsafe or that its customers and employees are subject to ongoing criminal activity. But unfortunately, that is the situation we and thousands of other small, medium, and large retailers find themselves in today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. And I'm sorry I've had so much difficulty. Did you say you were installing double doors to give a little more security to your stores?
No, we're putting, they're a pass-through drawer. So like a security, so the lobby will be closed still at night. But it will allow us to take care of customers from outside and run it through a security drawer.
Oh, a drawer.
Yes.
Okay, I thought you said door. Because we're going into the cannabis issue next, which has also this problem. So, okay. Thank you very much. Any questions? All right. Let's move on then into the next section, which is Shea Hines and Adam Espino with the Craft Cannabis Coalition. I'll just mention that we are aware of several major robberies at our retail cannabis locations, and including one worker who was killed in Tacoma last year and during a robbery. So we have very high concerns about this area of retail theft as well. So Adam, you have some ideas to propose, I understand.
Yes, and I appreciate the time to be here. So I just will say good afternoon to you, Chair Kaiser, and good afternoon to members of the committee. I am Aiden Espino Jr. I'm the Executive Director of the Craft Cannabis Coalition, an association of over 70 cannabis retail stores and allied producer processors statewide that advocate for industry growth and integrity. I'm joined here with CCC member Shea Hines of Lux Pot Shop, and we're both very appreciative for the chance to speak. I'm here mostly to say that cannabis stores thank you and this committee for your work last year to help address the issue with passing SB 5297 out of the Senate. We have been extremely appreciative of the continued work from members of this committee and the Liquor and Cannabis Board to address the safety of cannabis retail stores. The LCB really stepped up to assist stores by bringing in security consultants to advise stores, organizing law enforcement and store briefings, organizing public awareness campaigns, and elevating store owner and employee voices. Through this partnership, we have also worked closely with the LCB to develop policies to pursue in the upcoming legislative session, such as protecting store employee and owner privacy after a robbery, affordability of store security costs, and organizing data collections after robberies. But I wanted to hand it off to Shea Hines to talk about his experience as a store owner for further
Thank
detail.
Thank you, Aiden. Go ahead, Shea.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Shea Hines. I'm the co-founder of Lux Pot Shop. We're a family-owned and operated retail cannabis store here in Seattle, Washington. Grateful to have the committee draw attention to this very important issue of retail theft and specifically the armed robberies that my industry is facing. I've been in the industry for over a decade. During that time, I hadn't had any large security incidents at any of my stores until recently. Beginning of the year, we had 3 armed robberies. Robbers came into our stores with guns, put them in our employees' faces, demanded cash. The robberies this year has been, in 2022, the first half of the year, there was more robberies in the cannabis space than all of 2020 and 2021 combined. There's pretty compelling data that the industry has put together on this. You know, we've heard a lot about financial harms today from some of the businesses, and that's a reality, but I want to shed light on the real impact here for us in the cannabis industry, which is the impact to the people. The trauma to our staff, it's just immeasurable. You know, nobody should come into work with the fear of not going home at night. You know, this was mentioned earlier, but the violence in the cannabis space has escalated. We had a beloved community member in Tacoma murdered. We've had shootouts with police. We've had robbers murdered. We've had a staff member shot 5 times and miraculously survived. It's just, it's completely out of control. You know, and as cannabis retailers, you know, we work tirelessly to keep ourselves and our staff and our community safe, you know, trying many of the tactics that we've heard today, hiring armed security, closing our stores early, having, you know, points of entry to get people in, you know, in a controlled fashion. But the reality is we need support from our state leaders. You know, cannabis businesses specifically are often misrepresented, you know, in the state legislature and the community as these highly profitable businesses. And it's not the case. We're small businesses with one of the highest taxations of any business in America. You know, we have a combined excise and sales tax of over 47%, and we have the inability to deduct business costs on our IRS tax return. We pay tax on all money. And so it effectively means we have about a 90% tax rate for every dollar that comes in our store. You come in my store and spend $100, effectively 90 of the dollars are going to taxes of some sort. Not complaining, but that means there's $10, 10% left over to pay for our costs, and security is part of that. And so, you know, as small businesses, unlike a lot of these big box stores we hear from, we aren't able just to throw money at it. We have to be really measured, and it just makes it tough and quite frankly impossible for a lot of the smaller retailers to make the type of improvements they want to see: full-time security, double doors, pass-throughs, you know, things of that nature. And so, you know, tax credits for hiring security and doing security upgrades would be greatly appreciative. You know, we've been a great partner to the state, and you know, we're thankful to the LCB for the responsiveness on this issue. And, you know, the continued work to help small businesses like mine. So, you know, we look forward to continuing to work together in this upcoming legislative session. We appreciate all the commentary around this. It's a really important issue. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Shay. Thank you, Aiden. Have we got any questions for either? Excellent. Thank you all. We're going to move into the second part of our work session now. And on the adult entertainment industry, we're going to have a L&I overview with Allison Drake talking about the implementation of the Adult Entertainment Advisory Committee report. And Allison, could you go ahead and present what L&I has found?
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, members of the committee. Thank you for providing the opportunity to present. My name is Allison Drake, and I am the Policy and Stakeholder Engagement Advisor at the Washington State Department of Labor and Industries in the Division of Occupational Safety and Health. So today I'll be sharing some details about the outcomes of Engrossed House Bill 1756, as well as the work of the Adult Entertainer Advisory Committee, with specific focus on the recommendations report the committee submitted to the legislature in November of 2020. Next slide, please. So a little bit of background. EHB 1756 passed the legislature in 2019. A few key elements of the bill included a new requirement for adult entertainment establishments, which I'll refer to as clubs, to install panic buttons in specified areas of the club. And it also mandated the use of block lists, which bar admission to customers in specific circumstances. L&I engaged in rulemaking to address the panic buttons and block list requirement, and those rules took effect July 1st of this year. The bill also directed L&I to form an advisory committee. So the advisory committee was comprised of 11 members, 8 entertainers, 2 club representatives, and 1 labor advocate. The committee met approximately 16 times over the course of 2 years, and Elle and I was the convener and facilitator, but was not a voting member. So the committee was tasked with 2 primary focuses. The first was developing a Know Your Rights training, which is a requirement now for dancer licensing, and then also to identify and make recommendations to the legislature aimed at improving dancer safety and security. So it's important to note that committee members were there to represent their respective interests, and so there wasn't always consensus, but we did work to try and establish a space where everyone could share their honest feedback and perspectives as we work towards our goal of completing the training and then also submitting the recommendations report. Next slide, please. So just a quick overview on the state of the industry. Dancers must be individually licensed locally. So this is separate from the business license requirements for the club itself. There is that training requirement for dancer licensing, which took effect July 1 of 2020. So it requires that all dancers complete the Know Your Rights training. That training was developed by the Adult Entertainer Advisory Committee in partnership with Labor and Industries. So if a dancer already had a license prior to July 1st of 2020, they would have been required to show proof of training completion in order to renew after July 1st of that year. And then proof of training completion is now required as a condition for first-time licensing. And the training only has to be completed once. There are roughly 12 clubs in Washington State. A majority of those are located in and around King County, and 7 clubs have common interests for ownership and operation. Next slide, please. So now I'll outline the 4 recommendations that were submitted to the legislature. The first one focuses on allowing for the service of alcohol in clubs. A Washington State Liquor and Cannabis Board rules prescribe conduct that is prohibited on premises holding a liquor license. And that conduct includes activities which are contained in the definition of adult entertainment establishments. It's worth noting that this is the only recommendation that was unanimous. And some of the potential outcomes the committee identified as a result of alcohol service in the clubs included the ability to better regulate alcohol consumption by customers, expansion of customer base, potentially resulting in lowering house fees for dancers, and also increasing dancer choices for their personal interactions with customers. The second recommendation focused on the elimination of back rent charged to dancers. Dancers are charged house fees for each shift worked, and those fees are paid to the club for use of the stage and other facilities within the clubs. And these fees range from $65 to $165 per day, with an average of approximately $100 a day. Back rent results then if a dancer is unable to pay those required club fees, and back rent does compound daily. Next slide, please. The third recommendation submitted to the legislature focuses on a requirement for training for other club workers. So this training requirement would be different than the Know Your Rights training that I previously mentioned, which is limited to dancers. And the new training requirement would be aimed at other staff in the club. So managers, security, DJs, things like that, or folks like that. Staff are already required to take some government mandated trainings, but this additional training could be a way for other staff to be better prepared to identify workplace hazards and improve dancer safety. And then the fourth and final recommendation focuses on the establishment of minimum security staffing requirements for clubs. This is not something that is currently regulated by the law, but violence is an industry recognized hazard, and settings with limited and or undertrained security staff, in those environments, the risk to dancer safety increases, particularly in isolated conditions. So workplace hazards may currently be regulated by L&I through a club's accident prevention program, meaning L&I would investigate and could take enforcement action if a complaint was received asserting that the club's accident prevention program was not effective in practice. Next slide, please. And finally, I wanted to briefly highlight an additional element of the report that was submitted to the legislature, the committee identified several topics for ongoing discussion, but these were not submitted as formal recommendations, and they are outside of LNI's authority for enforcement or oversight. The additional considerations included municipal ordinances criminalizing dancer conduct, zoning laws limiting house fees charged to dancers, and the establishment of anti-discrimination protections tailored to adult entertainment. Next slide. So that concludes my presentation. My contact information is on the screen, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Allison. And I know Tammy Fallon is available as well if you have questions. Senator King, you have a question? Your hand is up.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious, is there any limit to the number of days these dancers can work in a row, or is it just that they have their own license and they can work as many days as they'd like? And then is there, what kind of protections do the dancers have in, as an example, getting to their car or whatever method to use to get to and from work?
Thank you for those questions, Senator King. So to your question about the number of days a dancer can work, I do know that we have other panelists as part of this portion of the committee meeting who might be able to speak a little bit better to that. My understanding is that any limitations around how many days a dancer might work in a specific club could potentially be outlined by the contract that is established between the dancer and the club directly. In terms of any limitations on the license itself and how much they can work, that's unfortunately not something I can speak to. And then again, in the context of, you know, safety provisions in place or measures taken to maintain dancer security upon departure from the club, it might be helpful to hear from members of the industry in that regard, because I would imagine there's some variability between the clubs in terms of what that looks like.
All right, thank you.
Well, I think we'll be talking with members of the industry right now. Madison, Zach Wu, I see you're available. If you could unmute yourself.
Hi, everyone. We actually have a video presentation that will be played. Thank you.
That's Alexa, yes. All right, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Alexa. I've been dancing for 4 years, and I love dancing because of the financial security, the fun challenges from making a sale, and the fulfillment that I get from bringing joy or comfort to a client of the club. I mainly dance in Washington, but I also work in other states. Working in Washington is a lot more draining and demanding than in other states. I feel less normalized or viewed negatively by customers, management, and the community when I'm working in Washington. I think this is largely tied to the ban of alcohol. Without alcohol sales, clubs have to front operation costs onto the dancers with high room fees and high house fees, and at the end of the night, I'm paying about $200 just to work. I feel like I'm treated as a house fee rather than a business partner when I'm working in Washington. And even though alcohol is banned, customers still come in overly intoxicated, but clubs are so desperate for a $20 cover charge, they let them in anyways. I've been told many times, we aren't the ones who served them, so therefore we can't deny service, and they let them in anyways, which I think is a lie to justify customer retention. In clubs that I've worked in that serve alcohol, customers are able to be monitored a lot more closely before they have the opportunity to harm a dancer. We also don't have the proper security measures to deal with customers like that. I believe if alcohol were served, the increased revenue would be able to staff clubs properly. In Washington clubs, there's less security on staff on hand than in any other state that I've worked in. The alcohol ban also makes the atmosphere of the club a little uninviting or awkward. Customers often come in, they pay cover, and they walk right out once they realize that there's no alcohol. In other states I've worked in, I can easily build rapport with a customer over a drink or sell drinks in general, and thus increase my overall profit. When I've danced in other states, I make more money at the end of the night, and I'm still paying out less in house fees. On top of this, Washington clubs have always been slow, but since COVID, there are nights where nobody even comes in. And in cities that do serve alcohol, they've been doing well post-COVID than Washington has ever done pre-COVID. And while other cities are better to work in, I feel rooted and comfortable in Washington, and I believe Washington dancers deserve to be treated better and positively and with respect. And I've worked in states where that's a reality. And Washington is my home, and I know we can make it better.
That's terrific. And now, did you have further comments to make, Madison?
We do. We have some slides. Thank you, Chair Kaiser and members. My name is Madison. I am the campaign manager for Strippers or Workers, and I myself have been dancing since 2016. Next slide, please. Strippers or Workers was created in 2018 by dancers, for dancers, and is led by dancers. We fight to raise Washington industry standards, rooted in the understanding that dancers are workers. Right now, Washington dancers are facing a predatory business model that strips workers of rights and fair pay. The previous testimony we viewed was by Alexa, one of our over 150 members of SAW. We also have engaged many more dancers in our projects, surveys, and outreach because we seek to be representative of dancers' needs and issues as a whole. We are a program of Working Washington, a workers' rights organization, and in 2018, we helped create the Dancer Safety and Security Bill, HB 1756. Next slide. Why is stripping important? Not only is stripping legitimate work, but historically, marginalized and discriminated people have utilized sex work to seek upward mobility and freedom. We recently conducted a survey of dancers around Washington, and our findings are in line with other research, showing that dancers are of largely marginalized demographics. 68% of dancers are people of color, and 68% are also LGBTQ+. 32% of dancers are caring for dependents, and 47% have a disability. Stripping's flexibility and low barrier to entry nature allows for these people facing adversities to access financial security and personal autonomy. Zowie, a Seattle dancer, wrote, "Stripping gives jobs to those in need of flexible hours, to moms who can't find sitters, for girls who go to school. Stripping is an art, a way to provide, and a way to live. It has given my children a life worth living," end quote. Keeping stripping accessible and making the industry equitable is supporting marginalized people. Next slide, please. SAW and dancers support the LNI recommendations for industry changes. As we heard earlier from Allison Drake, the committee developed the recommendations that are listed on this slide and range from topics such as alcohol service and club employee training and regulations of house fees, all of which I'll be discussing a little bit more later. It is important to consider that dancers are the most well-informed group on these issues, and the dancers on the committee voted unanimously for all of these recommendations. Similarly, all the dancers support the additional recommendations that were not put to vote. Next slide, please. A bit on what these recommendations do. As we heard from Alexa earlier, nightly house fees that dancers pay in Washington are so high, up to $160 a shift before other fees, that dancers can go home at the end of the night with no money or even owing money to the club's back rent. This is why regulation of house fees and eliminating back rent is important, so that dancers are making a fair wage. In comparison to a city like Portland, house fees can be as low as $20 a shift and there is no back rent, while dancers are making comparable or even better profits. Right now, there are no security or staff training minimums. Dancers experience that security is understaffed and that they and other club employees are not held to a reasonable level of conduct. But it should be noted that for these changes to be financially sustainable, as the industry is already struggling in Washington, alcohol needs to be legalized to offset costs of these changes. Alcohol will not only take the onus of profit off of dancers, balancing some of the power differential in the industry between clubs and dancers, but it will also help fund uplifting the industry standards. Overall, these recommended changes are becoming even more vital as COVID has deeply negatively impacted the Washington industry. 40% of dancers report a decrease in profits since COVID, and 32% of dancers report having to start jobs in other sex work roles to survive. Next slide, please. Why are these industry issues so prevalent in Washington and not in other places? Overall, our laws are not supportive of the industry, especially of dancers. The industry has been neglected and alienated in a way that has left dancers to fend for themselves while they carry the burdens of the industry. The unequal power balance between clubs and dancers has been left unchecked and is exacerbated by dancers being the only source of real profit for the clubs. These lack of industry standards are largely because of the stigma against stripping, but stigma should not dictate whether a group of workers can access basic. It is also no coincidence that stripping and sex work are harshly treated in sociopolitical climates and that sex workers are of marginalized groups. This is a continuation of systemic discrimination of minority people. In Washington, a lot of these issues are perpetuated by the alcohol prohibition. Right now, clubs and dancers have to fight for customers, profits, and positive club atmosphere. Legalizing alcohol normalizes the industry and makes it accessible, positively impacting the work culture, club conduct, dancer well-being, and profits, as seen in other states. In fact, Washington is the only state in the country that does not allow some form of alcohol service in clubs. Ash, a Washington dancer, said, "I've worked in clubs where alcohol and nudity is legal, and I've experienced more money. Working was easier. There was less violence, and my house fees are always lower." Next slide. While alcohol service may be an intimidating request, surprisingly, the academic research on strip clubs have found positive outcomes with alcohol service and less restrictive regulations on the dancer conduct, much like Oregon's regulations. In experiments, fewer restrictions on dancer nudity and proximity to the customer actually increased positive affect in the customer, leading them to be more positive towards the dancer. This was connected to making the dancers safer and the work more healthy. And since the overall experience was more enjoyable, it presumably makes the work more lucrative. Many studies have found alcohol service gives dancers more tools and autonomy in how they make their money and more protection from management in clubs. And finally, when compared to control sites, strip clubs were actually safer and connected to lessened crime rates. Researchers believe that this is because strip clubs that serve alcohol have a higher standard for security and regulations. Overall, dancers were safer and had more autonomy in clubs that have alcohol service. Next slide, please.
Madison, I'm going to need you to wrap up.
No problem. Not only does the academic research support these industry changes and the recommendations, but most importantly, the dancers support them. They've worked in many other states, 80% have worked in other places, and 95% of dancers believe alcohol prohibition negatively affects clubs. As previously mentioned, the dancers on the LNI Dancer Committee unanimously agreed to the recommendations. While Deja Vu and its coalition group Expressive Rights Alliance do not support all these recommendations, the majority of dancers are clear about what they want and need. Next slide, please. In summary, strippers are workers. They are marginalized people who are even in more need of rights and protections. All the recommendations are essential. Alcohol legalization in clubs is scientifically shown to be safe and positive, and SAW hopes to get the policy that executes these recommendations passed in 2023 legislative session. Thank you from SAW and the Dancers of Washington.
That was an excellent presentation, Madison. Very, very precise and very helpful. Thank you. I'd like to call now Eric Forbes and Winter Fink. And then we have one person after that as well. Go ahead. I don't know who's going first, Eric or?
Sure.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Eric Forbes. I'm the managing partner of 7 of the 12 adult establishments in Washington, as well as 2 liquor clubs in Oregon and a club in Colorado. Thank you for allowing me to speak. When this process began, it was before COVID, and the recommendations were finalized when we were still believing the pandemic was temporary. Being a business in Seattle was tough even before COVID. After, you know, this recovery has been really slow, we are seeing half the customers and half the entertainers that we had before the pandemic. So we feel more than ever we need to have venues that appeal to the general customer base, which alcohol does. We have a fantastic club in Portland. It serves alcohol. It's already at pre-pandemic numbers. We have lower dance fees there than we do in Washington. It's safe. It's an enjoyable place to work. I have to add that Madison's statistics on alcohol clubs, I feel like our club matches that perfectly. So I would agree with her on those points. We do not make use of any back rent policy in Oregon or Washington. That's been done away with. Every one of our entertainers are offered to be an employee, whether they are paid, where they are paid at above or minimum wage, plus a 20% commission that's offered to them before they ever start to work. But they overwhelmingly prefer the option where they lease our space for a set fee and keep all the money they make, which at times can be very substantial. We have already implemented changes consistent with this report. We feel like they've been very valuable, but we still have challenges. We have tried to work with the State Liquor Control Board for a few years now to find a pathway to allow some form of alcohol service. They've denied our request multiple times. They will not amend the plan, which I feel unfairly defines how an entertainer can choose to perform, and that's what's preventing us from being granted a liquor license. And when this is despite, as you've heard, passionate support from entertainers and other organizations that work on issues related to dancer rights. This whole process has raised some deeply important issues, and it's inspired me to find other ways to do better. I'm optimistic that the work we are doing right now through Expressive Rights Alliance can center community conversation about implementing reforms that improve relationships with partners. Like SAW, we want to be partners with them as well. Washington has the fewest number of legally regulated adult venues per capita in the country. For the first time, we are meeting across this community, and we recently adopted a code of ethics to demonstrate our commitment to dancers in our communities, all the clubs in Washington. We appreciate your consider on these recommendations, and we're ready to work collaboratively with you to implement policy. So we want to be your partner.
Thank you. That's a good message to hear, Eric.
Thank you.
Winter, and then after that will be Shira Cole. I'm going to have to get a cough drop, so go ahead. Go ahead, Winter.
Winter, you just need to unmute, hopefully.
Got us that time. Thank you. Sorry about that. Hello, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Winter Fink. I'm the Director of Operations for Deja Vu and Dream Girls in Washington, Oregon, and Colorado. I've worked as a dancer and manager in Washington for 29 years. I was honored to serve as the designated club representative on the Adult Entertainment Committee. My testimony is included at the end of the report. The issues we discussed through the committee process were challenging, but I appreciated the opportunity to share my experience and my perspective. The report was finalized early in the pandemic when we felt life would quickly go back to normal. The context is very different today. We still haven't returned to pre-COVID levels of operation in Washington. We struggle with all the same issues as other service businesses. Upon reopening, we adopted several report recommendations within our control. We listened and proactively ended the practice of back rent, shift scheduling, and lowered house fees to the degree possible. At a time of awareness of women's rights and bodily autonomy, we believe Washington can lead to reforming laws and approaches that have stigmatized and made it more challenging for dancers to make a good living. Legal and well-regulated venues for adult entertainment serve an important role in guarding against sexual exploitation. We hope to work with the committee to design policies that respond to the issues in this report with a willingness to embrace that the idea that there is a place for adult entertainment in our communities and there are models in other states that do work. The top thing that you can do for this industry right now is to develop a framework for alcohol service. This change helps improve the culture and therefore the safety. It attracts more employees, dancers, and customers and will help all of us recover. We have consistently expressed our openness to implement operational changes and trainings as discussed in this report. Thank you for the opportunity to participate in this process, and I look forward to continued dialogue with you about improving personal and economic security for all those who work in the adult entertainment community.
Thank you very much, Winter. That's really heartening to hear your both of your willingness to work with us as we try and move forward on this whole issue. Our final panelist today is Shira Cole with the Expressive Rights Alliance. Go ahead, Shira.
Hi, everybody. My name is Shira Cole. I'm a current dancer. Since 2006, I've worked in 27 clubs across 7 states, and 9 of those clubs are in Washington State. I've been a stripper activist fighting harmful legislation since 2006. I was very much involved in Strippers Are Workers and this committee. This year, I helped create the nonprofit Expressive Rights Alliance. Every club in the state has joined. Our mission is to protect freedoms and advance opportunities of Washington State's adult entertainment community. We are creating a new place for clubs and dancers to work together to improve equity and working conditions. I've been going into the clubs and hosting meetings to get input directly from dancers. These jobs are so important. Dancing enabled me to become a homeowner. I'm able to support my kids while being away from them for just a few hours a week. For a lot of us, dancing is our only path to independence. Dancing is the only widely available low barrier job that is high paying enough to work around the limitations of childcare. Dancing is the only in-person sexually oriented job where we are provided a community, security, and workplace regulations. Creating more jobs in this industry would attract workers away from more intense forms of sexually oriented work because this job pays so well to just give lap dances. Most of our problems are because of laws written without us. The alcohol ban, restrictions on dancer conduct, and limited hours of operation is limiting these job opportunities. Alcohol service makes our jobs safer. With alcohol service, our house fees would be far less. With alcohol service, there's enough customers to where dancers can choose the safer customer to dance with. The Washington State Coalition Against Domestic Violence signed on to our letter asking for alcohol because they recognize the link between financial security and escaping domestic violence. Money is the most effective avenue to safety. Our current laws are oppressive and sexist. Almost all of the laws specific to this industry are simply sexist laws written in gender-neutral language because these laws massively curb income potential for this type of work, this work being almost exclusively available only to women. In a true free country, we have choice. We need choices, and choosing between a low-paying job to barely get by or underground and dangerous forms of work is not a realistic choice. Participation from current dancers was very low in coming up with these recommendations. For example, this report fails to highlight issues that are extremely important to dancers, such as the right to set our own prices and keeping our right to choose our worker classification. Turning these recommendations into policy requires more engagement, and that's the work that I'm doing at ERA. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. I'm sorry, I've got a little business going on with my throat. This has really been very interesting work session. I hope committee members have found that as interesting as I have. I want to thank Senator Saldana for her good work on this area for the last two or three, even more years. And we have made some progress, and I think we'll be seeing some further future progress as well. Any final comments from members before we adjourn? Well, then, I will say that this work session of the Senate Labor, Commerce, and Tribal Affairs Committee is now adjourned. Thank you all.
Thank you, Madam Chair.